This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Army officials are on Capitol Hill today to answer questions from a Senate committee on the dilapidated housing and bureaucratic red tape that wounded service members face at Walter Reed Army Medical Center. We're going to spend most of this hour talking about that scandal with Dana Priest and Ann Hull, the Washington Post reporters who uncovered this story. If you have questions about what happened and why, you can email us now. The address is talk@npr.org. But first, a verdict today in the trial of Louis Scooter Libby, who resigned as Vice President Cheney's chief of staff when he was charged. The case goes back to the invasion of Iraq, when former Ambassador Joe Wilson challenged an important part of the administration's case for war. As part of an effort to discredit Wilson, Libby and other administration officials told reporters that Wilson's wife, Valerie Plame, was a CIA operative. Neither Libby nor anyone else has been charged with the leak, but today a jury found Libby guilty of one count of lying to the FBI. He was found not guilty on a similar count, guilty on obstruction of justice, and guilty on two counts of lying in sworn testimony before a grand jury, which is perjury. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik joins us here in Studio A. Thanks very much for coming in, David.
You bet.
And what does this verdict mean for Scooter Libby?
What this verdict means for Scooter Libby is, first, there's going to be a motion from his lawyers to ask for a new trial, just to set this trial entirely aside, and we can talk a bit later on about the legal ramifications. But it means that he's facing some fairly significant jail time, and it means that what had been sort of a political scandal has become a criminal one for the Bush White House, not exactly the legacy he hoped to leave for his patron, Vice President Cheney.
And that's the next question. What does this mean for the vice president and indeed for the White House?
A very uncomfortable time. Even before the verdict, President Bush was asked at a press conference, I believe his most recent one, about whether he would pardon Mr. Libby should he be convicted of anything. Mr. Bush sort of waved off that question, refused to entertain it. They don't want this to come inside in part because this is really all about going back to 2003 and the question of the invasion for Iraq. Was it justified? You know, popular opinion has swung so heavily against the war at this time and the way it's been conducted and how it's turned out. The problem with Ambassador Wilson for the White House was that he seemed to be knocking out some of the underpinnings of the justification at the time for invading Iraq. And it's sort of the focal point, the fulcrum of this administration is tied up in the Iraq war.
Without getting into too many details, it involved allegations that Iraq, Saddam Hussein's Iraq, was trying to buy uranium, a yellow cake as it's known, in Niger. Joe Wilson was sent to investigate these allegations. He found no support for them, and then later reported that back when he returned.
And it's very interesting. As you said at the top, you know, the White House was seeking to discredit him by linking him to his wife, this CIA agent. At the time, some liberal critics of the administration said what they're trying to do is punish him by revealing her, by outing her as an undercover agent. From what we know, there's not evidence to support that. What they seemed to be doing was thinking that their internal warfare in the administration, they were seeing opposition from CIA analysts and operatives to their analysis that Saddam had sought that very material. They thought, hey, if we can just link him to the CIA, he won't be seen as this independent arbiter. He will be seen as a compromised figure in this internal battle. They thought by linking him to the CIA through Valerie Plame, his wife, they were compromising and discrediting him. Instead, it was seen as a very brutal act of political fighting.
And not that he was sent to Niger as the best man to investigate, but rather sent as a program of patronage by his wife.
And the bitterly ironic thing for the administration was, in fact, the CIA sent somebody to Niger to do this specifically because the vice president in his office had pressured them so very much to go back again and again to find stray scraps of evidence to support the idea that Saddam Hussein's efforts to get material or weapons of mass destruction was an active one.
And the method of discrediting was an orchestrated program of leaks.
Well, the vice president said, let's see what we can find about this guy, former Ambassador Wilson, on the very day that his op-ed appeared. I believe it was July 6, 2003, in the New York Times. It was seen as sort of a punch to the solar plexus of the administration. Libby then went. He got the information about Valerie Plame, and he went and he talked about it. He talked about it first on a number of occasions with Judith Miller, then of the New York Times, later talked with Matthew Cooper. He was not alone in doing so. Former State Department official Richard Armitage did that.
He turned out to be, in fact, the source of the leak.
He turned out to be the initial person initially to talk to somebody outside the administration not entitled to learn of that. And that was, of course, Bob Woodward. It appears at the time from both men that he seemed to be sort of gossiping and bantering and swapping insidery juicy information without thinking of the import. Fleischer, the White House spokesman at the time. He was involved in leaking as well. Karl Rove, the presidential advisor who came very close to being indicted himself for lying to federal investigators. He, too, had talked to members of the press corps about this. They all ultimately cooperated with investigators. The difference here is that Mr. Libby said that he learned of Valerie Plame's identity from another journalist. That was Tim Russert of NBC News, and that was seen by a special prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald as essentially lying and obstruction of justice, leading the charges you described.
And convicted today on 4 of 5 counts. Let's go and hear some reaction. Here is the special prosecutor, Patrick Fitzgerald.
The results are actually sad. It's sad that we had a situation where a high-level official, a person who worked in the office of vice president, obstructed justice and lied under oath. We wish that had not happened, but it did. And I want to thank the colleagues and investigators behind me who worked hard to make sure that we brought that to light and brought it to court and proved it beyond a reasonable doubt. And we're gratified by the jury's verdict.
And now here's Mr. Libby's lawyer. He is Theodore Wells.
We are very disappointed in the verdict of the jurors. We intend to file a motion for a new trial, and if that is denied, we will appeal the conviction, and we have every confidence that ultimately Mr. Libby will be vindicated.
Joining us now is Jonathan Turley, a criminal defense attorney and professor of law at George Washington University. He's been writing about the Libby trial for USA Today. Good to see you again.
Thank you.
He's with us here in Studio 3A. One of the most interesting decisions about the case, Ted Wells, the lawyer we just heard, decided not to call either Vice President Cheney or the defendant, Scooter Libby, to testify.
I think the decision with Cheney made a lot of sense. By the time the government had wrapped up its case, calling in Cheney may have backfired. Cheney could have helped a lot by saying how busy these times were, but by simply entering the courtroom, he would reaffirm the importance of this matter and reaffirm the idea that this is something that should have stuck in Libby's mind. It's not something that you would forget about. This is one of the most powerful creatures on the planet, and he basically sent him on this task. The decision not to call Libby, I said at the time, I thought was a mistake, that this is the type of trial that the jurors expect to hear from the defendant. And you've got a lot of people saying that you're a liar. And the jury expects you to walk across the room and say you're not. Now, that doesn't mean that this is an easy choice for Ted Wells or the defense team. He would have walked into a buzzsaw. It would have been a terrible cross-examination by the government. But he was in a position where, frankly, I think the risk was worth it. Mm-hmm. It's much like, in many ways, the Martha Stewart case, where they rolled the same dice, hoped that the jury would pull them out. But even though they're not supposed to do it, if a jury doesn't hear from you in a case like this, they tend to resolve questions against you.
In an odd way, Libby ended up testifying against himself. They played tapes of his testimony before the grand jury. These tapes lasted, 2 days?
Right. And actually, I thought that magnified the problem because you have the guy sitting there. They hear him testifying before a grand jury, but he's not going to testify in front of them. And the only, in the end, when the government sat down after presenting its case in chief, I was convinced the only person that could save Libby was himself, that mm-hmm. he had to get on that stand, and he had to face that withering cross-examination.
One of the things that we learned in the course of this trial, Jonathan Turley, is some of the inside workings of what had been a fairly opaque White House, difficult to read. We saw how at least the vice president's office functioned.
I thought David put that in really terrific terms because this is perhaps the least visible, the least accessible White House. They are almost freakishly obsessed with secrecy, particularly Dick Cheney. And so that's why this became really the World Series for Washington. Everyone was watching every move. Suddenly we were hearing what was happening. And there's this scene of Dick Cheney at his desk when this article, New York Times, hits the stands. And he recognizes it immediately for what it is, that this would be a matchstick that could start a runaway fire. And he reacted. And he called the guy that he calls at moments like this, Scooter Libby. And what's interesting about the whole trial is that Libby now casts a shadow over the vice president. You could not get a piece of paper between Scooter Libby and Dick Cheney when they were working together. Mm. And a lot of people in this town are sort of snickering that Libby was not some rogue operator. He didn't go about obstructing justice or doing these types of things alone. And a lot of people are wondering why Dick Cheney, as well as Karl Rove, seemed to get a relative pass in the investigation.
Let me turn back to David Folkenflik. We also saw a lot of testimony from a lot of reporters and learned a lot about how relationships with the media and very important officials work. It was not always a pretty picture for two people. Judith Miller and indeed Tim Russert do not come off all that well.
Look, it was not a happy experience or era for the press corps in Washington writ large. Judith Miller in particular, obviously she served 85 days in jail as her attempt to protect her source. She ultimately was prevailed upon to accept the offer that had been sort of very tepidly given by Mr. Libby and his lawyers much earlier, that he was sort of waiving the protection there. She actually testified. Matthew Cooper testified. This prosecutor got everything he wanted from every reporter he asked for information on, whether they were supposedly anonymous protected sources or not. In addition, you learned the degree to which there was this was not sort of incredibly aerobic reporting by journalists. This was essentially very calculated leaks. This was the administration pressing a lot of levers in a lot of different ways to get out a line that it wanted.
And Jonathan Turley, quickly, this is going to be appealed. We heard Ted Wells say that. What are the prospects? You know, it's hard to tell right now, but what do you think?
Well, I have to say, I think the prospects are very poor. These are very difficult criminal counts to appeal because they turn on credibility, fact questions, where the jury gets a lot of deference on appeal. Frankly, I think his best bet is with a presidential pardon.
Sentencing set for May, and the president's going to face a lot of questions, not just about the pardon, David Folkenflik, but the White House says he's not going to answer them because there are ongoing legal proceedings, the same reason they gave for not answering these questions before.
Well, they certainly seem very happy to not answer questions on whatever grounds they can find.
David Folkenflik, NPR's media correspondent, with us here in Studio 3A. Our thanks as well to Jonathan Turley, professor of law at George Washington University. He's been writing about this case for USA Today, and we thank him for his time. Both of them joined us here in Studio 3A. Again, if you joined us late, Scooter Libby guilty on 4 of 5 counts. We'll be back with a look at the Washington Post's investigation of the Walter Reed scandal when we come back from a break. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.